Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Veterans Day, Armistice Day, the 11th of November. In this hour, we're going to be talking about war dogs. Our guest has written a book that just has become a bestseller in the last couple days. Rebecca Frankel, senior editor, special projects at Foreign Policy, and author of War Dogs, Tales of Canine Heroism, History, and Love. She has a regular Friday column, Rebecca's War Dog of the Week. And before Foreign Policy, she was managing editor of Moment magazine, which was founded by Elie Wiesel. She has written on many topics, the religious escapades of singer Bob Dylan to Hitler's family doctor. And she's appeared as a commentator on ABC World News and MSNBC. There's a lot in the book. It follows military dog handlers as they go through training. It explores the history of dogs in war. It looks at the bond between trainers and dogs, and also just some of the remarkable skills that dogs have that enabled them to be war dogs successfully, and certain breeds that really excel at that. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Rebecca during the course of this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at KDunnShow. I also want to ask her, although it's not the focus of the book, she does write very poignantly about dogs that have provided great comfort to families when their handlers have died in war. And it would seem to me as though it would be a really great for all of these vets who are suffering from post-traumatic stress. It seems to me that many people could benefit from having a dog as a therapy dog, because sometimes, you know, the best thing to talk to is your dog. It's really true. We're going to be welcoming phone calls again. 800-486-8655 is our number. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so the book became a bestseller. Holy Toledo, huh? Wow.
Yes, that was very exciting news to get.
Yeah, I'll bet it was. Let's start with the history of dogs in war, and also before we talk about handling of dogs now. It does go way back, doesn't it?
It really does, and I think it probably wouldn't be overstating things to say there were probably dogs on battlefields as long as there were men along. Mm. On them. But for the United States, I think it started, during the Revolutionary War. There's some great stories. One of them is about George Washington, in fact. The enemy commander, General Howe's dog, kind of got, I guess he got lost and ended up on the side where George Washington's men were. And they took the dog back to him, and he decided in a very gentlemanly way, because he was a great lover of dogs, to return the dog unharmed, without holding him for ransom or for any gain of his own. He realized that it would be not very sportsmanlike to use the dog against him.
And you also mentioned toward the end of your book Napoleon.
You know,
that's quite a story.
It is, and I almost can't read it without tearing up a little bit, because to think of, he says he's looking back on his life, really, and sort of when he was a general, and the experience that he writes about was coming into a battlefield and looking at sort of the wasted land and looking at all of the fallen men who were lying dead in the field, and he came across a dog. And the dog, upon seeing him, ran over to him and then ran back over to the man who you would assume was his master. And he kept nudging the man's hand and then running back to Napoleon. And he writes that at no point during all of the battles, during all of the wars that he fought in, was he ever so inclined to be forgiving or to show mercy on someone. But, of course, he couldn't do anything to help. And so it really just sort of shows the depth to which these dogs can kind of pierce the inside, and how emotional anyone can really become at seeing their devotion and seeing how much they're able to unconditionally love.
Yeah, they are. And this year we celebrate or mark the 100th anniversary of World War I. You write about the number of dogs, 75,000 dogs. Is that right on the ground in official war-related roles in World War I?
Yes, it was really incredible, the number of dogs that were used. And, of course, That was even without the United States having euthanized dogs, and that was really just the tally of the Allied forces, and then, of course, the enemy forces, which used them in great numbers, especially the Germans. And, of course, there were also the Red Cross dogs that were trained to, it was really amazing, they were trained to be able to, in at night, because they really do have very good vision when it's dark out, and they were able to sort of navigate the treacherous terrain of, you know, trench warfare, which, you know, there's a lot of really deep holes in the earth and lots of barbed wire, and they were able to navigate all of this and determine who among the men in the field were just wounded, or and of course they avoided the dead men, and they were trained to rip off a piece of uniform or bring back a helmet to their handlers, and then they would lead the handlers or the medics into the field so they could rescue the wounded men under the cover of night when it would be safe to do so.
Mm. In Vietnam, the dogs were used, and unfortunately, you talk about the dogs were left there because of the chaotic situation in which we left Vietnam. The dogs were left behind. They were used primarily as scouts, you write. What does it mean to be a scout when you're a dog?
So as one former scout handler, a Marine, Ron Aiello, explained it to me, is that he would walk in front of a patrol with his dog Stormy, and he would have the leash between them, and Stormy was always out in front, whether it was during the day or whether it was at night. And when he could feel her leash going taut, it meant that it was safe to continue forward, that nothing was preventing her from moving forward. But as soon as it went slack, it meant that he should stop everyone behind them and sort of use her ears. The way he explained it is that, you know, wherever her nose was pointing, if he sort of locked his gaze right directly in between her ears, the top of her head, then that was where the danger was coming from. Mm. And the dogs would do this work quietly so they wouldn't bark. And it gave them a tremendous advantage because, of course, in Vietnam, these men were navigating, you know, jungle warfare, but also guerrilla tactics, which they weren't really prepared for. You know, in World War II, it was a big war fighting with big weapons, but in Vietnam, they were battling snipers, and the Viet Cong had their tunnels, and there were booby traps, and so it was a much different kind of land warfare that they were fighting, and the dogs were able to sort of, they were trained to smell gunpowder, they were trained to smell bombs or mines.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that there's some record, someone has come up with a number that says they saved over 10,000 lives.
Oh my goodness, isn't that something?
It is, but of course, you know, if you talk to a handler from Vietnam, they'll say, oh, it was much more than that. The dog, if ever there was a dog out on the patrol, the possibility of them being caught unaware was lessened tremendously. So,
and many of them were left behind?
They were. Only a very few number of dogs actually made it out of Vietnam. And again, if you were to talk to any handler who served, they didn't know the dogs were going to be left. It didn't come out for many years later. And so in the same instance, this handler, Ron Aiello, he wanted to adopt Stormy. He wanted her to be home with him. That's how much he loved her. And he wrote the Marine Corps for years and years and never had any response. And only later did he find out that she had been left there with the other dogs.
Mm.
And he doesn't really know what happened to her.
Mm.
And as wonderful a guy and as happy as a guy he is, this is, you know, a hard thing for him to talk about.
Mm-hmm. I believe I heard you talking about somebody who appeared at one of your book signings, and he didn't talk to you. He just gave you, I believe it was it a picture of the dog he was in Vietnam with, or his tag or something like that? It was really this poignant moment.
Yeah, and it's as much as I've talked about this, I was sort of unprepared for this moment. And he handed me just a little post-it note, as a lot of people were doing with their correct spelling of their name or what they wanted written in the book.
Right.
And he just handed me the dog's name, which was Rex, and then what I took to mean his ID number. All the dogs get tattooed their ID numbers in their ears. And he didn't say anything. He just sort of looked at me, and I knew what he was communicating. And, you know, I made the dog to Rex. You know, I signed it for Rex. And he just sort of nodded and he left.
Yeah. As I was listening to some vets today on the radio earlier this morning, they were talking about the number of vets who are suffering from post-traumatic stress, the number of friends who have committed suicide. I mean, it's such a huge thing now with vets from Iraq and from Afghanistan. Before we talk about dogs in war, it was striking to me that, I mean, I've seen this work with so many people who are artistic and people who are dying. Sometimes to have a dog with you, as I'm sure almost everybody you interviewed for your book would tell you, can be a real lifesaver for people. I'm surprised the military doesn't have a huge therapy dog program for returning vets.
Right. Well, I think that they're making waves slowly but surely, but I think you're right. I mean, it's not a cure-all, but it makes a tremendous amount of difference. And one thing that was sort of consistent with every dog handler that I talked to that had or seen a really rough combat tour is they said they felt somehow insulated and protected by having their dog with them. And it was more than just a reminder of home. You know, it wasn't just as simple as that, but they felt that they came back more whole and in body and in spirit than some of their fellow soldiers or Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it. And one of the handlers that I got to know, I write about him in the book, his name is Matt Hadala, and he deployed with a bomb-sniffing dog named Chaney, and he eventually ended up adopting him and bringing him home. And he had been telling me that he'd had trouble sleeping, or, you know, he didn't quite feel like he was sitting back into place exactly as he thought he would. But when Chaney was at home with him, he said he felt more at home having him there. And he started sleeping better, started sleeping through the night. So,
and sometimes the dogs can come home with canine distress, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it makes sense, right, that, you know, we can't expect that they would go to combat zone and they're experiencing the same chaos and the same violence and the same loud noises, and then sort of the same trauma that the men and women who deploy see. And so, of course, that some of them are affected by it, some more permanently or more deeply than others. But they call it canine PTSD, so it's called CPTSD, and vets treat it with medication. And they also have their own kind of dog therapy to get them either back to a place where they feel like they can be confident sending them out on a mission, knowing that they'll be able to, you know, weather things without losing their mettle or, you know, losing their sense of self. And but sometimes it doesn't work all the way. Sometimes, you know, some dogs can still be working dogs, but just not in a combat zone.
Right.
And sometimes they just need to retire. You know, they saw too much, or it's too much of a strong memory for them, and they're not able to kind of get past it.
Mm-hmm. The dogs being used for sniffing out IEDs, you talk about why dogs are suited for this, particularly certain breeds of dogs. I was distributing this statistic all over the office today. The average dog has 220 million scent receptors in his nasal cavity. The average human has around 5 million. That's one heck of a lot of scent receptors, isn't it?
It is, and you kind of have to wonder, like, how it doesn't overwhelm them at times, right? If we walk by something and it smells particularly pungent, then what must it smell like to our dog?
Right.
But it's amazing, and it's not just that they have better noses than we have. It's the way they imprint odor is more complex and more layered. So handlers like to use the example of a stew or hamburger, something that has a lot of ingredients, but it's sort of communicates one smell. So when we walk into a kitchen, we know the smell of a hamburger, but there might also be cheese on the hamburger or bacon or avocado or, you know, other things that we're not able to pick out. But to us, it just sort of smells delicious like a hamburger. And that becomes incredibly useful when searching out IEDs because there isn't one exact recipe to build an IED. It can be used with varying amounts of certain ingredients, certain amount of C4, explosive materials. And so when they train dogs, they train them to smell all of the ingredients. And so when they alert on an IED or a bomb, it doesn't have to be the same smell every time. You know, maybe there's more det cord or maybe it's missing det cord this time. But they pick up the other smells and they know to give the alert.
Mm-hmm. So you went to, first of all, tell me how extensive the program is. Are there a lot of military bases in this country that are training war dogs or just a couple?
Well, some military bases have bigger kennels than others, but the ones that do have them, they're constantly working their dogs. And not all of their dogs might deploy into a combat zone, the role of a war dog can be just garrison work or patrol work on a base. And they're still defending the homeland. They're still defending, you know, U.S. soil, maybe in less dramatic ways, but their job is still important. And I think right now in the program there's about 1,500 dogs overall. I was recently talking to the head of the entire military working dog program. His name is Doug Miller, and he's stationed at Lackland Air Force Base where the dog training school is and where the very extensive and remarkable veterinary hospital is there. They call it the Walter Reed for Dogs, and it's all based out of Lackland. And so they are drawing down their numbers a little bit. At the height of our engagement in Iraq and Afghanistan, there were about 2,500 dogs throughout all of the branches working.
And it's under the purview of the Air Force, although all branches have it, but the Air Force is in charge?
Yes. So it's a little bit complicated. It took me kind of a while to figure out how this all works. But so the Air Force is the overseeing branch of the military, which is why the sort of hub of all of the military working dog community is at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. But the Marines have their own program. The Navy has its own program. The Army has its own program. And they do run things a little bit differently. If you look at the records from a Marine working dog, it might look different than the records of an Air Force working dog. So it's sometimes a little bit tricky to keep track of everything, but they do a good job of it. It is centralized. And also, the military dog community is relatively small compared to the entire military at large.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get into it? How do you become a trainer?
Well, I think that, you know, you have to find the right people on base. So depending on which branch you belong to, I think you would probably approach another handler, or you can talk to your commander about it. And it used to be incredibly difficult. It was a very challenging role to fill. There weren't as many handlers as there are now. And certainly, you know, back in the early 2000s, there wasn't the need for it. They sort of were filling the need of the time, which certainly didn't include combat missions. So they used to, one handler told me a story. You had to write an essay, and you also had to go through in front of a board of many different people, and you had to sort of talk about why you would feel that you were a good person for this role, and you had to take an entry exam. It's very challenging, and I think it is still challenging, but not to the same extent.
Mm-hmm. So would these be people who naturally just love dogs and know about the special bond, or are they learning about what that bond can be?
I think it's a mix. You know, I was sort of surprised initially. I expected, and certainly many of the handlers I talked to had that experience. They had dogs growing up, or their parents had trained dogs, or somebody in their family had been a dog handler, and whether a police canine officer. But I did interview a few men and women who didn't really have much experience with dogs, but they kind of learned it as they went. Either they saw somebody on a handler on base, or they heard stories and just thought, wow, I really want to do that. But they all, I think in the end, they all sort of have to have the same respect and love for the animals in order to do their job well.
Mm-hmm. And I know at one point you kind of took a hold of a leash, and I'm wondering if you did that with quite a bit of trepidation, or did you feel like you were ready to take on this job?
Well, I think, you know, part of my experience being a reporter and going to these different bases was that I was very much a guest, and I was a little bit of an intrusive guest. You know, I was watching these handlers train, and that probably made some of them very uncomfortable to have, you know, a person they didn't know there with a camera,
sure,
and
right,
a pen and paper, you know, keeping track of their every move. So whenever they asked me if I wanted to participate, I felt that I had to at least try. And certainly it would probably not do my reputation any good if I said, oh, no, thanks. I don't want
right,
to try that.
Right.
But on this particular occasion, they definitely turned it around on me. I had a whole group of people very amused to watch me try to find a bomb in a bathroom. the dog I was working with, his name is Haas. He is a German short-haired pointer, very friendly, pretty friendly dog. I thought we'd been getting along pretty well. And I was just watching one of the other handlers go around the room, and then Sergeant Cannell, who was the kennel master at Buckley Air Force Base in Colorado said, okay, Rebecca, here, give it a try. And I said, okay, sure, I can do that. I had just been watching 6 hours of training, so I figured I could at least try it. And he handed me the leash, and I said, okay, well, what do I do? And he said, just go find the bomb.
right.
Okay, sure. So I tried to be confident, and I, you know, the dog just kept looking back at his handler like, what are you doing to me? Who is this lady? And, you know, I brought him around the room, and I gave the command seek, and he followed me. And so I thought, okay, we can do this. And we went through one sort of side of the room, and then it got very complicated when we had to maneuver into all the different bathroom stalls because I had to get him into the bathroom, and then I had to, you know, maneuver my way in the bathroom and get him to, you know, sniff around the toilet and then get him out. But he wanted to go much faster than I was prepared to go. And we got all tangled up and the bathroom door was knocking me in the back. And the amazing thing is that, you know, I could feel my face getting red. I knew I was blushing and I could tell, I knew all these people were watching me. And in my head, I just thought, I can't do this. But I still was going through the motions of trying to get Haas to continue sniffing. But as soon as I had that thought, he just sat down right in the middle of the bathroom and looked over at them and said, nope, she can't do this.
Oh, no.
But it was an amazing lesson for me to learn because they were all making, the handlers I'd been watching were making it look so easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, one, it's not easy, and two, you know, this dog didn't trust me. He knew that I wasn't up to snuff, and he knew that I didn't know what I was doing. And my frustration, you know, handlers will say the emotions run up and down the leash.
Hmm.
So if you're getting frustrated, your dog is going to feel your frustration.
Hmm.
They're very sponge-like that way.
And imagine the trust you have to go into war with a dog. My gosh, it's got to be just so, so strong.
I think so. And, you know, I certainly saw this with my own eyes being, you know, fortunate enough to observe so many handlers training. The closer they were, the better they performed. It was pretty simple. It seems pretty simple to me that, you know, the more bond or affection or love, if we can call it that, there is between a dog and a handler, to me, it seemed that they functioned much better as a team.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Rebecca, and here's how you reach us. Rebecca Frankel is the author of War Dogs, which has just in the last couple days become a bestseller, Tales of Canine Heroism, History, and Love. We have yet to talk about some of the soldiers and their dogs. I mean, some of these stories are just tear at your heart because the dog, well, I won't even tell you what the stories are, but we'll talk about some of those. It's more than going into war. It's, you know, an incredible bond between the dog and the human. And the book, you can't write about this without talking about war as well, and without looking at the moments of tenderness, the moments of realization that maybe there's a better way when you look at what's happened with dogs and humans. And so there are all these stories in the book, as well as information about, you know, what kind of training they do and what dogs are used and how dogs have been used for war throughout history. We welcome your phone calls. Maybe some of you listening are trainers in the military. That would be wonderful. We had Rex with us, a bomb sniffing dog whose owner adopted Rex after he retired. They both retired. He was with University of Wisconsin Campus Police Force, and that dog spent a lot of time with us, and we have an understanding and appreciation of the kind of work that dog was. He would comb out all our areas in the studio, and quite something to behold. So join us. Did I give you the number? I'm so much thinking about dogs, I forget. I'm on the radio. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Rebecca Frankel has been writing about war dogs in her Friday column, Rebecca's War Dog of the Week. For Foreign Policy. It's a highly viewed piece in Foreign Policy's history, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The National Geographic. She's been a commentator on ABC World News and MSNBC, and she is currently senior editor of Special Projects at Foreign Policy Magazine. So we welcome phone calls, and we'll take them if you want to call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Rebecca Frankel, and her book is War Dogs, Tales of Canine Heroism, History, and Love. And we're going to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Dennis in Waupaca. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Just wondering if one of the dogs is killed in combat, are they given a full military funeral, or how are they honored?
Well, it sort of depends, but actually, yes, dogs are sort of treated like any other serviceman or woman. I've seen footage of services that are held in the combat zone. When a dog is killed, they give them a service, and also when they come back, they'll be honored again at the home station where they were based. And these services are rendered with extreme dignity. And you see how emotional not only the handlers are, but the other people who served with them.
Thank you, Dennis, very much for the call. Dave in Milwaukee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you today?
All right, how are
you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead, Dave.
Well, I had heard about a year ago that there was an organization trying to adopt these dogs out that were done with the military service. I was wondering if you all knew anything about that.
Well, I don't know about a particular organization, but I can tell you that when a military's dog career is coming to an end, there's actually quite an involved process in terms of how they're out-processed out of their service. So they get the veterinarian who has all the dog's records, they get the kennel master, and they get an animal behaviorist who can look at the dog and sort of say, okay, this dog is suitable for a house with children, or this dog shouldn't be in a house where there are other dogs. And then usually what happens is there's a long line of handlers who have worked with that dog who want to adopt the dog. But there's also a waiting list for civilians who want to adopt military dogs. I think there's about 1,200 people right now who are on the waiting list. So it's rather long. But they do adopt out a fairly high number of dogs each year. It's a couple of hundred, if not more, because, of course, all dogs who come into service don't necessarily make good war dogs, but it doesn't mean they are not going to be wonderful house dogs. So that's usually how it works.
So how about you, Rebecca? Did you get the desire to have a doggie?
Oh, my goodness. There were a few of them that I would have taken home with me had I been craftier or knew that maybe they weren't so terribly needed. But I do miss being around them. I really do.
Yeah.
This is all wonderful, you know, sharing the book and sharing all these stories that I was trusted with. But I do miss being out there with those guys and their dogs.
Yeah. Do when you do book signings, do any handlers come with their dogs? Do you get to see some dogs at these events?
I haven't yet. Although somebody did come with a service dog in training, which was wonderful. We invited them to event, and so it's the organization is called America's Vet Dogs, and they do the very thing we were talking about before, which is providing therapy dogs and service dogs with veterans who come back who either have physical impairments now or they have emotional or psychological ones.
Mm-hmm. Dave, thanks very much for the call. Stigma in Madison. Hi.
Oh, yeah. You know, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I have PTSD, so I know the unconditional love you get from a pet is magic. And each year we put about 4 million dogs and cats to sleep. So if more people knew how helpful they can be, and even in prison they had rodents, and in Nelson Mandela's prison and prison over here, they had to get cats for the rodents. And the prisoners, they all adopted a kitty cat, and these purring little fur balls, they stopped screaming and hitting each other. And in one death row inmate, he was worried what would happen to his kitty cat when he was gone. And one young man who hadn't spoken in years started speaking. So pets and animals are really so amazing.
They are. They are that. Actually, what you just said reminded me of a story about Judy. She was an English pointer, I think, and she was the only dog prisoner of war ever on record. She was in a Japanese internment camp, And a Royal Air Forceman, whose name is escaping me right now, but he adopted her in the camp. And she, when the men were beaten, she would run out from wherever she was and try and intervene and protect them. And he wrote years later that the one thing that kept him going was to know that if he died or if he gave up, he couldn't bear to think what would happen to her. So she saved his life in many ways, but she also sort of gave him a reason to keep with it, to not give up.
Yeah. Tell us the story. I wrote his name down, but I can't remember what it is offhand. Of the, I believe it was Lance Corporal Ashley, was it, who was killed in Afghanistan, I believe, and his dog came home and was with the family, and they were so comforted that they had his dog. Is that his name?
It was actually Colton Rusk.
There you go. Okay.
Private First Class Colton Rusk. He was shot by a sniper in Afghanistan. He had only been there not very long, in fact, but he had deployed with his bomb-sniffing dog, Eli.
Mm.
And what was remarkable about their story is that when Colton was shot, Eli climbed on top of his fallen body to protect him. And the Marine Corps doesn't do this very often, but they offered Eli to the family, to the Rusk family. And after they were sort of reassured that Eli couldn't be sent back out to stay with Colton's fellow Marines, they agreed to take him very happily. And the very first thing that Eli did when he got to their house was run right into Colton's room because he could smell.
Right.
And talking to his mother, Kathy Rusk, she's a really wonderful person. She has one of those voices that's just so warm and so sweet. And actually talking to her for me was a little bit hard, and my heart broke for her because she talked about how it was so difficult losing her son, but how wonderful it was to have Eli with them. He was a part of their son, and he was a way to keep him alive. But he also brought tremendous comfort to all the members in their family. You know, he gave her a reason to keep getting up out of bed because he needs taken care of. And, yeah.
Right. And was he the one who went on and had puppies?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they breeded Eli, not to sell the puppies, but because they wanted to give them to the other men and women that Colton had served with. And a couple of their family members have adopted little puppies, and they're all black, just like Eli is. And I think it's brought a tremendous amount of happiness, knowing that there's a piece of Colton, a piece of their son, kind of continuing on in the world.
Absolutely. And maybe for a long time. Dan in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, Dan, how are you?
Hi, good.
Good.
USA Today had a story on the working dogs, Army working dogs, and they're still being left behind. The problem is the Army and military classifies the dog as a piece of equipment, and they're leaving billions of dollars of equipment behind in Iraq and then Afghanistan as they're pulling out. And the dogs are being left behind, too, unless the last handler that handles the dog wants the dog. Chain of command okays that the handler can take the dog, and the handler has to pay for the shipping of the dog back, which can run a couple $1,000s. Now, there's a bill pending in Congress. I emailed my representative and my two senators, and I got a response from one of them, Durbin. I got a response from my representative, Kelly, and they said there is a bill that's been pending in Congress to stop the military from listing the dogs as material.
Hmm.
And also to pay for the shipping of the dog back if the handler wants the dog. And I thought we got over that in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Vietnam, they're leaving those dogs behind on a regular
time. I just want to jump in. It's really unfortunate, actually, that the USA Today ran that piece because it's not true. I'm familiar with the article. And I can understand where some of the confusion about this comes in, but in no document that I've ever come across, or that Doug Miller, who is the head of the entire military working dog program, are the dogs ever listed as equipment. And so what happens when a dog team deploys is they always deploy together. They leave their home stations together and they come back to their home stations together. And even if the handler is killed in action, as Joshua Ashley was another Marine handler who was killed in Afghanistan, and July of 2012. His dog Sirius wasn't left there, but another handler, a Marine handler who'd lost his dog, brought Joshua Ashley's dog Sirius back with him. It's really too bad. This is one of the worst and probably the most pervasive rumors about military working dogs. And it's unfortunate we can't stamp it out with just some good fact-checking.
Right.
Because I think, you know, what is happening a little bit is that home station doesn't always necessarily mean the United States, the continental United States. And there are some dogs who are assigned to home stations in other countries. And if their handlers finish their tours or finish their time at these stations and they're sent to somewhere else in the United States, the military doesn't necessarily pay. It's quite expensive, and if you think about all the Cisco belt tightening that's going on in our military, unfortunately they don't have extra funds to send dogs to handlers who want to adopt them, especially when there's somebody in the area where the dog is stationed who is willing to adopt them. But there are wonderful nonprofits that have sort of taken up this cause to, you know, reuniting handlers, and so they help fund that extra trip. But unfortunately, the military doesn't have the money, and certainly the dog programs don't have the spare funds to sort of furnish that extra cost. But certainly no dogs are being left behind. It's not, I've heard these crazy things about how dogs are left there in shelters or they're just sort of left on their own. And you know, there's two reasons why that would never happen. And one, because the military invests thousands and thousands of dollars in these dogs, so they wouldn't leave something so valuable behind. And that's sort of the kind of cold, calculating way to look right at that. And then the difference between now and Vietnam is that the handlers in Vietnam didn't know this was happening. But there's no way that the handlers couldn't know if this really was happening, and there's no way that they would allow it to happen. So if anyone else comes across this information, you know, please let's try and make sure people know it's really not happening.
Well, I hope the paper corrected itself. That's not right.
It isn't right.
No.
But to this day, I don't think the I wrote something about it. I did a few interviews. I called a bunch of people and I asked them, you know, why do you think this is still happening? And I think it was just a sloppy job. Mm. You know, I don't like saying that about somebody else who calls himself a journalist, but that's really what it was.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Dan, for your call. I hope that was a comforting answer in some ways. I'm sure you get this from people, so let's get this question out because I'm interested in the response, too. Becca on Facebook says she feels badly for the dogs. They don't volunteer for this. Is it cruel to use them as tools? Do others feel like that? Can you address that issue?
Yeah, so this question comes up, and I certainly think it's a valuable one to ask. But usually what I say, and this is honestly what I believe, is I sort of use my experience as the basis for my answer, and that is that every dog that I was able to watch and see loved what they were doing. I never came across any instance where a dog was reluctant or sort of forced into this work. Even if they weren't doing a very good job at it, they certainly seemed pleased and happy to be there because they were there with the humans that they were connected to. I'm sure some people might say, well, you know, it's not fair then to sort of take that bond and manipulate it to use. But I also think that I don't know how many dogs we ask if they want to be house dogs. It doesn't mean that they don't enjoy their lives as a house dog. But I think that many of these working dogs have the temperament for...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, they have very high drives, they have a very high energy, and I think it would be cruel to keep them, say, in a kennel all day, or only to take them out for walks once a day. So that's always my answer to that.
They have jobs. They're working, right?
They do have jobs, yeah. And they're working. And, you know, some of these dogs, even when the handlers are tired and ready to be done, they could still keep going. That's sort of the kind of level of energy. And certainly they slow down, and when they do, that's when somebody who cares about them, and they do care about these dogs, the veterinarians, the kennel masters, their handlers, they decide that, okay, this dog is sort of done, that he's ready to be a house dog. And so they retire.
Oh, you need one of those, Rebecca. You really do.
I think so.
I know you do. Your life would be even better. It really would be. You need a dog. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Rebecca Frankel is our guest. Her book is War Dogs, Tales of Canine Heroism, History, and Love. You should see the picture that's on the cover. And it's real, too. It's incredible. Go to our Facebook page to find that, The Kathleen Dunn Show. She also has all these wonderful quotes. I love this one. I'm going to put this one on my refrigerator throughout the book. If there are no dogs in heaven, then when I die, I want to go where they went, Will Rogers. This is The Ideas, number 800-486-8655. This is The Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking this hour about war dogs on this Armistice Day, Veterans Day. Rebecca Frankel is our guest, and her book is War Dogs, Tales of Canine Heroism, History, and Love. And let's go to more phone calls. Shannon in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to tell you about my retirement plans. And it basically, it revolves around taking dogs out of high-kill shelters, retraining them, and then donating to servicemen for issues like PTSD, bigger dogs for balance stability, anything that I could get them, retrain them to do, to give to a veteran. That's what I plan on doing with all my retirement funds.
Oh, Shannon, that sounds wonderful. Do you have dogs now?
Right now I have a monster Labrador. He's 125 pounds.
Whoa.
His mother was a border collie.
Oh, my gosh. What kind of life is he having?
Lazy.
Yeah.
He's up there in age, so he's pretty lazy now. But when he was a puppy, he was very active, and we go out and meet people, and I take him around to the nursing homes. And
Very nice.
That's a good retirement plan.
Yeah, it's terrific. Mine is similar lines. I want to raise therapy dogs, too. Thank you, Shannon, so much for your call. Fred in Madison, hi.
Hello, ma'am. I'm a VA physician, and it's very good. We've been... the dog programs, they're excellent. The problem is the bureaucracy. But that's not what I wanted to talk to you about. I was in Vietnam in 2004, and I spent some time with a Vietnamese intelligence officer, and he showed me that many descendants of our of the dogs we left behind. I also know that the troops were ordered to shoot their dogs, and almost none of them did. I've got several dogs. There is a book called From Baghdad and Back that talks about how a found dog, not a military working dog, basically saved a whole bunch of troops, not just by saving them for the battle stuff, but kept them sane. And the book talks about how a whole chain of command of Marines disobeyed standing orders to get that dog back to California.
Oh.
So it shows you the tremendous value of these animals.
Right.
One more thing I want to leave you with. The German military has always had a lot of dogs in it. In World War I, every unit had a dog, and when they disbanded, the dogs were given a pension, a soldier's pension, and the dogs were left to be taken care of by veterans who had, German veterans who had Shaker's disease, or what we would now call PTSD. These dogs are an amazing thing, and the good that they can do is huge. The thing about them is that if you take, first thing, it's best if the veterans together train their basic dogs together because they get unit cohesion. It's great. The dog's not a defense dog, but the thing is, if you have a dog, you can sleep at night because when you're in country, you always have your weapon, you always have someone watching on you, and you always have a scent.
Mm-hmm.
When we, and by the way, the veterans have to acquire their own dog. I certify the veteran as meeting the criterion for a dog, but it's all up to them. The short story that I told the senator that got the initial money for it, which later was sent to Palo Alto and taken away from us, but was that if you have a dog, you're going to if you don't take care of it, you're going to be stepping on stuff.
Rebecca.
Well, this actually reminds me of lots of stories that I heard. I think Germany was always a little bit ahead of the rest of us in terms of recognizing how significant and useful dogs could be in war. But the French also, they would take retired war dogs and they would train them to be guide dogs. And they were doing this ahead of many other countries. But there was such a stigma attached to a lot of these soldiers had been wounded in battle by gas, and so they had gone blind. And unfortunately, there was such a stigma attached to being blind at the time that the service of a dog somehow, you know, resonated with something entirely negative. Whereas today, you know, I think we're much more conscientious and we recognize this sort of how amazing it is to be able to partner with an animal.
Absolutely.
In that way.
Yeah. Thanks, Fred. Libby in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Libby.
I can't hear you very well, but I wanted to respond to an earlier caller that there is an organization out of the Chicago area called Save a Vet. And their mission is to try to rehabilitate not only the dogs of war, but also dogs, service dogs for police and law enforcement. And they are accept donations, but they also are trying to match dogs with military veterans who need additional help, and they're providing housing and rehabilitation for both the dogs as well as the veterans. And that's all I have.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the book, and thank you for the program.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the call. You want to respond, Rebecca?
I think it's, you know, it's great. I know that there are a lot of organizations who do work like this, and I think, you know, bringing attention to them and getting people sort of aware of how they contribute is always a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Willem in Colfax. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Willem.
I had heard or I listened to a book about, I don't know if it was this book, but another book that said that almost all the dogs are these Belgian Malinois, and a lot of them are, or almost all of them are purchased in Europe. Is that true, and do they train these dogs in the United States as well? And why? Because they pay a lot of money for these dogs, highly trained dogs.
They do. It's definitely a very big investment in terms of the military's budget and in terms of these individual programs and their budget. And as far as I know, they do primarily come from Europe, and they are oftentimes Belgian Malinois and German Shepherds, and those two breeds are used because of the Shepherds in particular because of how intelligent they are, also certainly because of their size. And the Belgian Malinois have an incredibly high work drive. They are really, really intense working dogs. And I think, you know, the military uses them because they're able to have the breeders come to them. It's a sort of a time and efficiency in some ways, as opposed to scouring around and being able to sort of go through the process of maybe looking at some of these shelters, which I know people have suggested the idea that, you know, it's not necessarily the breed, but it's the individual mm-hmm. dog who might prove to be a good war dog. And I think most handlers probably wouldn't argue with that. But this is the system that they've set up. And the Air Force also has its own breeding program at Lackland Air Force Base. So a lot of the training and even some of the dogs are bred right here in the United States.
Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us. So much interest in the topic. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, have fun with your dog when you get it.
Oh, I will send you a picture.
Thank you. War Dogs is the name of the book, Tales of Canine Heroism, History, and Love. And on this Veterans Day, Armistice Day, we thought we would end with the famous poem that marked the armistice, the end of World War I. And here it is.
In Flanders Fields by John McCrae. In Flanders Fields the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row that mark our place. And in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.